Discusses the Truth, 5 o'clock Wednesdays. It's actually the 5:16 hour p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We have very special guest joining us and waiting in the wings here for us. Dermaid McCulloch, British ecclesiastic historian. He's currently professor of history at the Church at Oxford University. We just ended with John Waters out of Dublin, fighting for human rights regarding the COVID-19 pandemic and his views on mandatory lockdowns. Earlier today at the 1 o'clock hour, we had on Oxford PhD, former Fulbright scholar to Brazil, J.P. Lindstroth. So without further ado, I will be bringing on Dermaid here in a moment. I will also want to readdress at the latter of this program here, Congressional Record Proceedings and Debates of the 76th Congress, Third Session, Honorable J. Thorkelson, House of Representatives. This dates back to August 19th, 1940. And I will explain why I believe that is, should be of interest to you. So, bringing on Dermaid McCulloch right now via Skype, Skyping him in. Okay, that did not work. Let's try this avenue here. Bear with me. Thank you. One moment. Let's try this here. And now.
Hello?
Hello, Dermaid.
Hello.
Ian Trottier, nice to connect with you. Welcome to Discussions of Truth. And thank you for staying up at the late hour to join the program.
Okay.
Did I pronounce your name right? Dermaid.
Dermaid, yes.
Dermaid. Dermaid, would you please take a moment here for listeners and give a brief introduction. You are an ecclesiastic historian, currently lecturing at Oxford University. Would you please give a further introduction for listeners so they understand who you are and what you do?
Yes, my name is Dermaid McCulloch. I'm professor just retired of the history of the church in the University of Oxford. And my career has been in 16th century history to begin with, and the history of Christianity generally. I've just published a major biography of the Tudor statesman Thomas Cromwell.
Wonderful, and congratulations on your retirement. You have actually written books, one of them, well, many of them, I'm sure, award-winning. One of them is certainly, I'm seeing, a New York Times bestseller, History of Christianity. Now, one of the things I want to extract for listeners early on here immediately is that you grew up, from my understanding, a member of the Church of England. However, you left that organization, if I'm correct, because of their treatment of homosexuality. Is that correct?
Not exactly, no. I was ordained a deacon in the Church of England and wasn't able to proceed to priesthood because of being in a gay relationship. So I'm still ordained and close into the Church of England and associated with the local parish church.
And okay, so you are still currently going to and active in the Church of England, is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. Now, your work won, this would be History of Christianity, the first 3,000 years, inspired a 2009 BBC TV series of the same name. The book won McGill University's Peter Kundil Prize for Historian. What is, and a 3,000 years, of course, is a long period of time. But you're in the UK, and certainly the United States, is where I'm at. We are product basically of English people, primarily, initially anyway, the founding thereof. And one of the distinctions thereof is the creation of the Church of England, from what I understand, it dates back to Henry VIII. Isn't that correct?
In a formal sense, yes, Henry VIII broke with the Pope over a political circumstance, really, or a personal one. He was married to someone he dearly wanted not to be married to, because he wanted to be married to someone else, and the trouble was that no one but the Pope could authorize that in the existing setup. And after a long tangle trying to get that, Henry came to the conclusion the only way would be to declare himself head of the church. Now, that wasn't actually a Protestant Reformation. The Protestant Reformation was going on in other parts of Europe, and Henry created a church which, in which there were people who pushed it towards a Protestant Reformation. So the English Reformation's a long, complicated business. And it was really in the reigns of Henry's children, Edward VI and Queen Elizabeth I, that you can talk about a Protestant Reformation officially in England.
Now, has the Church of England, I'm going to assume not, has the Church of England changed any of their views or policies on homosexuality?
Well, yeah, the Church of England is thoroughly confused, like most Christian churches are, about how to move on matters sexual. It's still confused, and its policies are inconsistent and in many ways ridiculous. So, for instance, there are now a lot of clergy in the Church of England who are in civil partnerships. That's, in other words, a marriage not in church, and there are, and the church has had to recognise those, partly because it, when it was opposing actual same-sex marriage, it said, "Oh well, of course we accept civil partnerships between people of the same sex." So when clergy actually entered civil partnerships, there's nothing much they could do about them, to the extent that they have to pay church pensions to the partners. In circumstances of bereavement, so that's part of the story. There are the church is internally divided between conservatives and liberals about how to go forward, and it's difficult to see how that division will be resolved. And no doubt, in the usual fashion of the Church of England, it will be an untidy and slow resolution.
Why, in your opinion, dear maid, why homosexuality is a natural act? It's a natural persuasion, decision. This is something that that caters to every individual's choice. Why, in your view, why would this be considered? Can I say it? A sin by this religious organization?
Well, because Christianity generally is based on a library of sacred texts, the first bit of which is the library of sacred texts of the Jewish people, and the second half, the New Testament, is a series of writings of the first century of the Christian era. And both those traditions are opposed to same-sex relations. These writings were composed in a world where there were cultures in which same-sex relations were regarded as perfectly normal in very specialized forms, Greek culture, for instance, and then Roman culture. But the Christian tradition had a pretty fixed hostility to same-sex relationships. And all the time, really, it's relations between men that matter in that tradition. Women just not considered, because these are texts written by men for men. And the church has to cope with this heritage of hostility in its sacred literature. It's not surprising it's had problems turning so radically away from that tradition in the last 150 years towards the sort of views which you've just set out, that there's nothing unnatural about same-sex relations. Well, that's a very 20th century way of looking at it. And it's difficult for religious organizations to enter a dialogue with their sacred literature. Now, as far as I'm concerned, the Bible is simply wrong about same-sex relations. It says very little which is any help at all. And it's very difficult for a church to be that straightforward about its attitudes to a major moral problem. Same thing you could say about slavery, for instance, which is clearly accepted as part of the norm in the Bible. What do you do with that? Well, in the last 200 years, Western Christians have said, well, the Bible is simply wrong on this. Slavery is a very bad thing, and we shouldn't allow it under any circumstances. So Christianity in the West has already done a complete U-turn on a major moral issue. It will have to do it on this one too. And of course, many sections of the Christian church have already done that U-turn. But it's very difficult for Christianity as a whole to make any sort of common decision on that.
Has the Church of England done its own thinking on this matter, or are they simply adopting a Roman approach and philosophy to this?
No, the Church of England has done a lot of thought and argued endlessly about it. I say the Church of England, Anglican theologians, Anglican clergy, Anglican lay people have said done an extraordinary amount of good thinking alongside other Christian churches. The British Methodist Church, for instance, has done some equally hard thinking, got slightly further with it. The problem is that when the Church of England tries to form some common theological mind on same-sex relations, it can't, because it's still deeply divided between a noisy conservative minority and a much more tolerant liberal majority.
Does the Roman Catholic Church still have a large influencing presence in how the Church of England operates?
No. No. They're parallel churches. Of course, the Church of England respects the attitudes of the Roman Catholic Church, but that's not to say that it won't express its disagreement with them on a whole range of matters.
You hosted a BBC series, as far as I'm seeing, titled "How God Made the English." Speak a little bit about that.
Well, the title, of course, is ironical, and it was a consideration of English identity. Partly because there has been a tradition in the life of England over its 1,000 years or so of existence of thinking that England is rather special. England is not unique in that. You could look at Hungary or the United States for similar ideas that God has particularly favoured that particular place. But the series, which is in three parts, examine what it was to be English and made the point to start with that actually, England, as a concept, sprang out of Christianity. There was no such place as England before the turn to Christianity in the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. And there was a church in England before there was England, with its organization, which, of course, was part of the Western church, the Roman church. And so I looked at that. I looked at the other complacent English myth that England is a uniquely tolerant country. Well, no, it isn't. It's got a history of intolerance towards Jews, for instance. England was the first kingdom in the whole of Europe to expel all its Jewish population in the 13th century. Then, at the Reformation, it became extremely intolerant towards Roman Catholicism. So I did a lot of myth-busting. I looked at the myth of there being an English race, a racial type of Englishness, not so. And so the whole series was intended to debunk a lot of national myths. It was intended to be a contribution to a debate which has, alas, gone in another direction. Now, our government has taken us out of the European Union, a profoundly stupid, narcissistic thing to do. And it's partly in reference to these complacent English myths about the English past. Perhaps not surprisingly, the British Broadcasting Corporation, the BBC, have only broadcast this series once.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What importance, in your view, Dear Maid, what importance does religion have in a government?
Well, as you know, England is odd in that it not just has an established church, but uniquely among world countries, apart from Iran, it's actually got religious leaders in its parliament. Bishops of the Church of England. So in formal terms, there is a close relationship, and it helps that our very much beloved monarch, Elizabeth II, is a devout Anglican and takes her role as Supreme Governor of the Church of England very seriously. So there are lots of ways in which the Church of England is still very embedded in national life. Of course, at the moment, we're in the middle of a passionate debate, which, of course, echoed the US, about the closing of churches during the present coronavirus epidemic. And the Church of England has been very supportive of government efforts to lock down the country. It's closed all its churches and even forbade its clergy to go in them unless their house is actually physically joined to the church building. That's just about to be relaxed. But it's caused a lot of anguish and a lot of heart-searching. It's meant that the church has gone virtual, like the rest of the nation. So it's a complex picture. And of course, only a small proportion of the population go to church these days, perhaps a tenth of the population, very different from the United States. But people go to churches. I'd say that churches in this country have never been so cherished or better looked after than they have at the present day. And so people are complex, and the situation in religion and government and the state is complex here.
Now, when you say churches, people are going to various religious institutions outside of the Church of England, and that is common? Is that what you're saying?
No, it's church buildings. The thousands on thousands of beautiful and historic church buildings in our country are very, very much cherished by people, and particularly the great cathedrals of the Church of England and one or two of the Roman Catholic Church. They are hugely cherished, and to their enormous surprise in the last 10 or 15 years, they found that their congregations have got larger. And certainly general visiting has gone up to these great buildings. And it's not just tourism. It's people look to these buildings for a sense of continuity, a space to get away from the pressures of modern life, to be quiet, to appreciate the beauty of music and architecture. So that's very interesting, and again has caused a lot of anguish, the fact that people can't go to them now, that choirs can't sing.
Yeah, that's I'd like to get your view on COVID-19, but you brought up something interesting, and you You mentioned before England was England, there was a church, I believe this is what you said, there was a church before England was England in England. Historically, Constantine, what is known as Constantine the Great, I believe he was crowned emperor of Rome, and I think it was split west and east at that time, but it, introducing Christianity. And I believe that happened in York, in England. But talk a little bit about this, and of course we can thread in the Norman conquest, that it, that'd be William the Conqueror, 1066, I think it was. But of course there was a Roman establishment there. Talk a little bit about that, about the presence of church before England was England.
Yeah, well, there were two Roman provinces which spanned a lot of the islands which make up the British Isles at the moment. And when the Roman authorities left, when the armies left, the government disintegrated, a church was left behind, but it was largely the church of those who were not Anglo-Saxons. Anglo-Saxons began arriving in towards the end of the empire. And by the 6th century, you know, a couple of centuries after the legions had gone, most of what is now England was occupied by peoples who thought of themselves in these new ways, Anglo-Saxons particularly. They were not Christians. And missions came from the parts of the islands which were Christian. But another mission came from Rome. And that mission, which arrived in 597 of the Christian era, established a church very much aligned with the Pope, with bishops at Canterbury and York and other former Roman towns. And so that organization was there in place. At the time, there was nothing called England. There was a series of Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. And the church was the only sort of unifying thing among these kingdoms, and gradually that spread the idea of a place called Engelland, the country of the Angles and Saxons. And that, to cut a very long story short, by the 10th century had become a single kingdom, and it was that kingdom which the Normans then conquered in 1066. By then, very centralized, very unified, and its church very much part of the Western Church under the Bishop of Rome, the Pope. And that's the way things stayed until Henry VIII broke with Rome in 1533.
And these Anglo-Saxon establishments, those identifying with that, what were they? They didn't have the church per se from Rome, as you mentioned. Were these pagan theology, or
they'd been non-Christian, and they were converted during the sixth, seventh century, remarkably quickly, and the Christian church in these Anglo-Saxon kingdoms became extremely lively and exported missions to Northern Europe, to the folks back home, as they might have seen it. And they were a major force in bringing more parts of Europe into the Christian world, which had largely been confined to the areas which had been part of the Roman Empire before.
The breakaway of the Church of England, in your view, Diarmaid, was that a good thing?
Well, the creation of the Church of England.
Yeah.
Well, good thing, but it's very difficult when you're talking about something so big. It created a very distinctive form of Christianity, which was very much part of the Reformation to start with, so very much Protestant. But because of the unique circumstance that it kept cathedrals among its churches, the place where the bishop had his throne, but much more than that, places with elaborate choirs, all that survived the English Reformation, and that gave English Protestantism a slightly different edge to that even in Scotland, let alone across the water in mainland Europe. And it's out of that rather complex form of Protestantism with its own flavour that Anglicanism developed, which in the United States would be the Episcopal Church of the USA. And it's a form of Christianity which is conscious of a Protestant past, but it's also conscious of being Catholic, whatever that might mean. So it's a church which has broken away from the Roman Catholic tradition, but has been in a conversation with it ever since the 16th century. And that's distinctive, and it's become one strand in world Christianity, Anglicanism. And you'll find it wherever the former British Empire was, but beyond that. And that's something which I regard as rather precious, because it's a thoughtful form of Christianity. A form of Christianity which takes its past seriously, which has a complex relationship with the Bible, which has a rich tradition of worship, liturgy, music, all that's good.
The influence of the printing press, how did that change the religious landscape in Europe, in your view?
Hugely important, because it speeded up communications very much. And Protestantism is based on text, the text of the Bible. And for that purpose, you need lots of text. And printing enables you to have lots of text. It also enables you to print things about this text, discussions of it, music, hymns. Mm. So printing is really, really important. It just speeds up the communication of something which is all about communication, Protestantism.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about 2020. Let's bring things current day. What, in your view, what is going on globally? What are your views and opinions with COVID-19?
Well, it's a pandemic. The world has seen pandemics before. It's rarely seen pandemics with so many human beings alive. That makes a difference.
Good point.
And the speed of communication, again, is hugely important, because it would be very unlikely for such a pandemic to have spread so quickly before. And it's facing a society where everything has become dependent on that intercommunication.
Right.
And with complex systems of distributing food and all sorts of things like that. So for this pandemic to be contained, we've had to do something really without precedent, which is to keep people away from each other. And that's very distinctive. We've been able to do it at an extraordinarily fortunate moment. If this had happened 20 years ago, we'd have been out without easy means of communicating with each other virtually. And it would have been far more difficult, far more causing of anguish to individuals. This time round, we've got the internet. And that has enabled us to keep communication going. And it's, of course, shown us the bad things about the way things were at the beginning of the year. Our awful reliance on fossil fuels and the ridiculous amount of travelling we did in order to make the system work. So now we know that committee meetings, for instance, do not need to be held face-to-face. Mm-hmm. So much business, so much work can be done from home, and a large proportion of people much prefer that. So transport, for instance, in the United Kingdom has fallen by 95% in the last month.
Wow.
And the effects are remarkably good in many ways. The atmosphere is cleaner, there's less noise, city centres are wonderfully clear. So there are a great many interesting and positive lessons to be learned. There is also the social change which has become very apparent. Half of us can sit at home and have things delivered to us, and the other half of us are delivering them. There's a very stark divide, the people out there keeping the system going and those of us who are keeping the system going by not moving. That will have profound effects. And in our country too, it's enabled us to reassess the huge benefits of our National Health Service, which had been much under attack from particularly the Conservative government in the last 10 years, been trying to privatise it, strip it of resources. Well, that won't be possible in future because a huge wave of national affection has gone out to our National Health Service, and woe betide anyone who tries to mess with it in future. So all these things will work themselves out as we come to terms with the pandemic.
Yeah, that's a good point that you bring up. But I guess talking about church closures and, of course, a religion amongst other things, I believe that that gives inspiration to people. A virtual meeting is different from a physical meeting, yet the physical meeting in the actual church building is, of course, not happening, to my understanding right now, and I don't know. What are certainly there's differences here to take into consideration. What's the projection in the UK? I think the UK has now taken over Italy in number of deaths. In the United States, I believe it's totally out of control. It seems unfortunately to say. What are your thoughts in regards to that for listeners in the UK or wherever they may be? Because again, I think there's this desire for people to meet and congregate in that, for instance, church building, which is so beautiful, inspirational, bright, lovely, the stained glass windows, whatever it may be, but they're not able to do that. And perhaps there's type of virtual meeting. What are your comments?
Well, virtual meetings for those, of course, and not everyone can join them because they haven't got computers, but for those of us who can, life has kept going. My church has had its virtual meetings. We've got a parish priest who's really very good at it and has enabled us to go on worshipping and see each other, which is nice in a church context. What will happen in the long term, the bishops of the Church of England have just begun the relaxation. They've said that clergy can preside at services in their locked churches. So that's a big concession, straightforward. I think the next one will be allowing private prayer and very small services. But the big problem is music, as Germany has made clear. You can have services and you can distance people, but one thing you cannot allow until there's a decent vaccine is singing. Because singing pushes out the virus like nothing else by its nature. So choirs are in a terrible position looking forward. Our wonderful cathedral choirs, all the sorts of choirs which give people such joy, can't operate until there is a reliable vaccine. And that could be next year. Right. And this is awful for cathedrals, particularly with their wonderful choral tradition. How can you keep that going? How can you train choirs? The tradition of young people coming into them, which keeps them vital. So many problems. And the finance of churches is really difficult because up till now, they've still been dependent on something like the old collection plate, people putting the equivalent of money down. And it's just not there. So churches are appealing to their congregations, please, you know, go online and give us the equivalents. But more than that, cathedrals, which depend on the huge numbers coming and dropping something in the box when they visit, that's all gone. As is, of course, the case with museums and stately homes, and so much of our national life depends on that casual giving, which has kept the system going.
Yeah, I've been fortunate enough to be inside and hear singing in the Salisbury Cathedral, and really, it's absolutely just fascinating. You were knighted in 2012 by your wonderful Queen Elizabeth II. Yeah. You've recently retired. Dear Maid, tell listeners what they can expect from you in the future. Are you still writing? What can they expect from you?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Having done Thomas Cromwell, I wanted a complete change away from that sort of detailed Tudor history. So I'm writing another very general book, and this time it's on the theme of sex and the church. In fact, it's going to be called Sex and the Church, A History. And it's going to look at all Christianity throughout its 2,000 years of existence and see how it's grappled with problems of sex, the marriage, the family, and how it's changed its views in that time about these things. So it's a task which is going to keep me busy for the next 3 or 4 years, and I'm doing the reading for it very happily at home, thinking about it. And I hope that people will enjoy it. It's meant to be a book not just to entertain or instruct, but to help with the really, really severe arguments among Christians at the moment, and non-Christians, and try and offer some sanity, if you like, on these very personal questions.
Wonderful, and so important, I believe, in today's age. Dear Maid, thank you for joining Discusses Your Truth. It's been a real pleasure to host you. Thank you very much.
Good night.
Dear Maid McCullough, again, it's for him, it's approaching midnight. He is a British ecclesiastic historian. And he earned his BA and MA and PhD from Cambridge. So to have that mind join the program has been remarkable. Let me segue, and he brought up a very, very good point in the fact that, look, if this pandemic, it's not the first the world has seen, and you've heard me discuss angles that I go down and critique and look at in regards to how various governments have dealt with controlling it, preventing it, slowing it. But let's take a minute here and look at what Dear Maid, and even though he, as I mentioned, he was knighted, so he would be Sir. From my understanding, he likes to be addressed as he was being addressed. Look, if this had happened 20 years ago, the rapid transmission of information would not be as accessible as it is today. So in many ways, the information superhighway and the negatives, unfortunately, that it has brought has, in that regard, been an advantage for dealing with the pandemic. And he brought up a very good point. Because of that, perhaps, we have seen far less deaths. So a good spin, a good look to consider. Let me now segue briefly into, because again, I like to look at the financials. Ronan Palin, professor of economics based in London, had talked about the hidden nature of finance sabotage, along with Anastasia Nestavalova, That is their current book. That is their newest book. They joined the program about a month ago. And unfortunately, with money, which all it basically does is represent natural resource, right? So you take, for instance, the abolishment of the gold standard in the early 70s by Richard Nixon. Why did he abolish the gold standard? Why is it that the Federal Reserve says they have no gold and the U.S. Treasury say they have no gold? So is there gold in Fort Knox? It hasn't been audited. And the Federal Reserve, for that matter, which isn't federal, it's a private central bank, isn't audited. So what does, in the United States, that dollar truly and really represent? Are there manipulative strings that are being pulled in the very complex global system economically? Hard to find out and identify, but yes, very possibly could be happening. So, in regards to Ronan Palin and the comment that he made in that the City of London, or rather the Corporation of London, not the metropolitan area of London that encompasses Westminster, i.e., but is a very small neighborhood in the center of London. Yes, Ronan Palin said on this program that it is a Roman mechanism that still exists. So I believe I opened up the program talking about George Washington. If I hadn't, then let me talk for a moment before I close the episode. George Washington owned shares in the Bank of England during the American Revolution. So why would he be owning shares of what would seem to be an enemy's bank? Well, per Ronan Palin, where the Bank of England is housed, which is the Corporation of London, or rather the actual City of London, which is a sovereign district inside the metropolitan City of London, it is a central, or rather reflects characteristics of a central banking mechanism that would therefore coincide with the later development of 1776, 1913, Woodrow Wilson, the establishment of what we know now as the Federal Reserve. Does it truly and really represent the people of America? Does the Corporation of London truly and really represent the people of England? Or no? That's my question. That's the argument. Because if you thread there in George Washington owning shares of the Bank of England, if those shares truly represented the soldiers fighting the adversary, which would be the revolutionaries in America, then George is playing both sides. He's playing both sides regardless. But my guess, my view, is that those shares didn't actually represent the military he was fighting. Whereas those shares were not representing the people of England. So, now, let me insert this quote from 1940s. Congressional record, proceeding and debate of the 76th Congress, third session. This is the United States of America. Title, introductory title. Steps toward British Union, a world state, capital S, and international strife, part one. Remarks of Honorable J. Thorkelson, and that would be Jacob Thorkelson, born in Norway. Okay, these are the remarks. Mr. Thorkelson, Mr. Speaker, in order that the American people may have a clearer understanding of those who, over a period of years, have been undermining this republic, in order to return it to the British Empire, I have inserted in the record a number of articles to prove this point. This will soon, by the way, be available at iantrache.com under the Articles tab. Okay, continuing. These articles are entitled, quote, Steps Toward British Union, A World State, and International Strife, end quote. This is part one. And in this one, I include a hope expressed by Mr. Andrew Carnegie in his book entitled Triumphant Democracy. In this, he expressed himself in this manner. Quote by Andrew Carnegie from his publication Triumphant Democracy. Let men say what they will. I say that as surely as the sun in the heavens once shone upon Britain and America united, so surely is it one morning to rise, to shine upon, to greet again the reunited states. Again, repeating, the reunited states. The British American Union. This is from Andrew Carnegie. The statement is clear, the report continues. And the organization which Mr. Carnegie endowed have spent millions in order to bring this about. This thing has been made possible by scholarships, exchange professors, subsidies of churches, subsidies of educational institutions, all of them working for the purpose of eliminating Americanism, as was taught once in our schools, and to gradually exchange this for an English version of our history. We are speaking, I am speaking English at the moment. Okay, this is in the August 19, 1940 report. U.S. Congressional Record, Proceedings and Debates of the 76th Congress, Third Session. I will soon have it up at iantrache.com. I'll continue, and then I'll wrap up this edition of Discussions of Truth. Continuing, these organizations were organized to bring about a British Union, a union in which the United States would again become a part of the British Empire. However, this has been upset to some extent by the attempts of the internationalists to establish their own government as an international or world union. Again, this is an excerpt from Congressional Record in 1940, U.S. House of Representatives. Continuing. And there is, therefore, a conflict between the two, for England wants a British Union with America as a colony, and the international money changers want a different controlled union. Please see link when available. In order to establish their own world government. It is therefore, and they're bringing in a religion of Judaism, it is therefore best for us to stay out of both of these in order to save what is left of this republic as it was given to us in 1787. U.S. Constitution, by people who knew more about international intrigue and the real problem that confronted the world than we know today. The early founders not only understood the problem, but in drafting the Constitution, they provided an instrument for us to follow so that we could remain secure from foreign double dealing and intrigue. Okay. There I leave it. For you to ponder and consider and move forward with your life dealing with a global pandemic, COVID-19, and catch that discussion, catch the episode with John Waters, former Irish colonist, a columnist who's fighting right now for what he believes in are inalienable human rights, as he is basically against mandatory lockdowns. He's suggesting, and he's for, voluntary lockdowns. I insert this. If you're at your web browser, go to it right now. Type in right now, just for your consideration, WO2020060606. Okay, that is an actual patent owned by Microsoft right now. and it is aimed at creating a cryptocurrency software that mines off of microchipped human beings. This is real. This is happening. This is the day and age that we are living in. What the future brings, none of us know. But I thank you, and I thank Diarmaid McCullough for joining the program. Contribute to the show. Should you desire, follow me on Twitter. Follow me on Instagram. IANTROTTIER. And until next week. And by the way, next week I will be hosting Den Bishop, author of Healthcare Reform. Oh, how the United States could benefit from that. Until next week, folks. Thanks for tuning in. Spread the message. Share with a friend. Share with a family member. Share with loved ones. Keep fighting the fight out there. Stay healthy and be awesome.